Hello, you are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 FM, and this is Karen Motokaitis, host of How She Really Does It, where inspiration and possibility meet. My lifelong quest has been to use inspirational success stories to motivate and empower others to achieve their best. How She Really Does It dives into the depths of people's lives in order to help others realize their own personal potential and goals. This talk show is meant to inspire, empower, entertain, and be a resource. Healing and recovery. How much does our mind have to do with our body? Nationally renowned psychiatrist, physician, researcher, and lecturer Dr. David Hawkins returns as a guest on our show today. He is also the author of Power vs. Force, and his latest book is Healing and Recovery. Dr. Hawkins, hello and welcome.
Well, it's good to be speaking to you again.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, Yes, and where are you located physically?
I'm physically in Davis, California.
Oh, okay, fine. Uh-huh.
Yep. So a little north of you.
Yes, a bit.
So how are you today?
Yeah, very good, and I'm glad people like the new book. I like it myself, and it just turned out very well. There were lectures I'd given over the years, and upon prompting by others, I brought them all together in one book, and I was very satisfied and happy with the result. And I'm my worst critic, so if I'm happy with the book, I know it's okay.
There you go. So I want to talk with you because I'm really fascinated about the mind and the thoughts. And I think when I talked to you a little over a year ago, I didn't really understand how important our thoughts are and how they can really affect our body. And so I wanted to hear what you had to say about that.
Well, the power is in the mind. And people pay a lot of attention to the body, but the body is really at the effect of the mind. The mind is more powerful than the body. And so to address illness then, of course we don't ignore the body. We treat everything physically, mentally, and spiritually. We do all we can for the body, and we look at our mental attitudes, and we work on our spiritual evolution. Because the higher the level of consciousness, the less prone we are to physical ailments and have greater capacity to heal them. We know that there's a whole scale of consciousness, and the lower one's level of consciousness, the greater the likelihood of illness. The higher the level of consciousness, the less likely. Presented a calibrated scale of consciousness from 1 to 1,000. And the higher the level of consciousness, the greater the capacity for self-healing. So holding positive thoughts in mind tends to activate a different side of the brain than negative thoughts. And in the book, I have a diagram showing how that comes about. But the left side of the brain has to do with animal survival. It has to do with fight versus flight. And it releases adrenaline and stress hormones. Now, the more benign side of the personality, the part that, of course, benefits most from spiritual endeavor, is the right side of the brain. And the right side of the brain has to do with healing and recovery. It has to do with the release of endorphins. And we're all pretty familiar now with endorphins, especially oxytocin. Which is very high in maternity. So the positive attitude, spiritual orientation, activates the side of the brain that releases healing neurotransmitters in the brain. And fearful, negative, and hateful thoughts activate the other side of the brain, which releases adrenaline and sets you up for fight or flight. So to have a benign attitude towards yourself and towards the world increases your resistance to illness. And then on top of that, we found that just a simple belief system is enough to give you an illness. People say, how can that be true? Well, things that you pick up from the TV, things you pick up from your family when you're young, tend to become belief systems, and these beliefs then tend to materialize in the physical domain. So if somebody says, you know, hay fever runs in our family, the next thing you know, you're going to be sneezing and blowing your nose when you're out in the field because you believe it now. Now, the interesting thing about those belief systems is if you hypnotize a person and remove that belief system, they're no longer allergic to anything. Interestingly, this was originally discovered by a psychoanalyst who had a patient that was very allergic to roses. And one day the patient went in for her appointment, sat in the waiting room, and there was a big display of roses in the waiting room. So when she went in to see her analyst, And she was furious. She says, you know I'm allergic to roses, and you got a whole bunch of them in the waiting room. And now listen to me, and she's wheezing and carrying on. And he said, those are paper roses. If you think you're allergic to roses, paper roses will give you an allergy. So that's the power of belief systems. Another very interesting example of that is multiple personalities. You know, there's people who have multiple personalities. Sometimes they'll be into one personality and other times another. It's like a whole personality takes over. Well, the one personality has all kinds of allergies and illnesses, and when that personality is dominant, the person has all these illnesses and allergies, and when that personality leaves and another one comes in that doesn't believe in all that, the person doesn't have any of those illnesses or allergies anymore. Yeah, so that just demonstrates the power of belief systems are so powerful. So the mind is where the power resides. Well, that's very good for us as humans, because if we're not just victims of the body, then we can alter our thoughts and our attitudes and become healthier just as a result of the more positive mental state. That's one of the great benefits of spiritual programs and endeavors. And of course, we see the example of A Course in Miracles, where you see recoveries from almost every ailment known to mankind. And you have the 12-step recovery groups, where you see recovery from alcohol and drugs and various other addictions. So if mental attitudes, as demonstrated just by example of these groups, shows that you can recover from anything. So I always say, no matter what ails you, find the nearest recovery group, or that you, especially if one related to your particular illness, and throw yourself into it wholeheartedly. And we've seen recovery from every ailment known to mankind. And of course, I was in practice for 50 years and had a very huge clinic. And we had a group of people made up from A Course in Miracles. All of them had hopeless illnesses. All of them had hopeless, incurable illnesses. And as time went by, almost all of them completely recovered and returned to a normal life. So we see the enormous power of the mind over the body and over the emotions. And so that gives everybody hope that by improving themselves mentally, their ailments will disappear or at least become manageable. Yeah? In that book, I list, I had a whole series of serious illnesses throughout my life, and I think I listed 27 of them altogether, 27 serious illnesses, all of which were intractable and chronic, and for which I went to many doctors. And so I know from personal experience that they can be overcome, because all 27 of them have disappeared, from hemorrhagic duodenal ulcers to, I can't remember them all. I had gangrene in the fingertips and all kinds of strange illnesses.
Are you healthier now than when you were in your 40s?
Well, I began recovering from all these things during those decades. And now I don't have any active illnesses. I have a new one I'm working on currently, arthritis of old age. I got it, my ankle, I got up and my ankles were sore, and then I saw a foot doctor and he gave me a shot of cortisone, and then next thing you knew, my shoulders were sore. So I went to see an acupuncturist and got acupuncture for sore shoulders. And the last time I saw the foot and ankle doctor, I said, you know what I think I got? He said, what? He said, I think I got arthritis of old age. Well, our society believes as you get old, you get creaky joints and aches and pains in your arthritis of old age. So I'm currently working on
For those of you tuning in, we have Dr. David Hawkins. He's the author of his latest book, Healing and Recovery. And he's also an internationally known spiritual teacher, author, speaker, psychiatrist, physician, and researcher. This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It. So, Dr. Hawkins, I want to hear about, and I'm sure our listeners are sparking interest because you do talk about this in your book, but how do you go about working on arthritis of old age? Is it the thought of arthritis of old age that you're working on?
Well, that's my newest one. So that makes 28 illnesses. I had to add one more, I guess, when I'm in my 80s. These all come about through the collective consciousness of mankind. You know, we develop cultural beliefs in all these things, and we give them energy, and when we give them energy, we give them power over us. And the interesting thing is that the power is in the mind, and the body merely complies with what the mind believes. It's like the mind creates a pattern, and then the mental belief system affects the etheric body, and the physical body then responds to the etheric body. The etheric body is an energy body, very similar, almost identical to the physical body, but it's where the energy is. You know, the physical body is just material protoplasm, but it doesn't know anything, can't do anything. It just sits there like a lump on the log. It takes the etheric body to activate this body and make it conform to your will. So my newest one now is to cancel arthritis of old age, which is, you know, a very common belief system. As I look back now, I realize all my grandparents had it. When you get old, your joints get creaky. That's a common belief system. And so anyway, today I don't have any arthritis of old age. And I'm the same age I was yesterday, but a day later, I've gotten one up on it.
You know, as I was reading your book and I was thinking about this, I have a 7-year-old daughter, and a couple years ago, the doctor had mentioned she might have allergies, you know, just from the pollen and stuff. And so it's interesting because my daughter really buys into that thought, and even though she hasn't really had any true symptoms since maybe a couple years ago, and that was a questionable, you know, that was just something that was kind of brought about. But and I understand, like, I could see, you know, some people that I've run across through life that maybe were negative and then they became ill, and I can understand that. That when I became troubled, though, was when I started thinking about just a few people that I either know personally or like a public figure like Dr. Randy Pausch. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He was a professor at Carnegie Mellon, and he tried to live life as a Tigger instead of an Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. And so when I was reading your book, I thought, well, what about him? How does this apply to him? And how did his energy or how did his thoughts bring about pancreatic cancer? So that's where I got really troubled with this.
You were troubled with the idea that thoughts could bring on pancreatic cancer?
Or that if it is so much of our thoughts that can bring about... here's my question. Is it our thoughts that bring about illness?
Oh, well, it's our emotional level of development.
Okay.
And our level of consciousness. You know, I developed a scale 1 to 1,000. Everything below 200 is negative. 200 and up is positive. So the majority of mankind calibrate below 200 on that scale. The majority of people have negative attitudes that are they're dominated by, and they are not dominated by adherence and admiration for truth. They're dominated by their personal belief systems, which have nothing to do with truth. But so the positive attitudes have to do with forgiveness and the benevolence towards others. And I say the one that serves me the most, serves most people the most, is to have goodwill towards all of life in all of its expressions. People say, well, how can you have goodwill towards a world like this where war and all this kind of thing goes on? Well, if that was true, nobody would ever be well, because mankind has been at war 93% of recorded history. 93% I'm 82, and there's been war ever since I've been on the planet, half a dozen wars. I was in World War II myself, and so you say, well, I can't have peace of mind or positive attitudes because of what's going on in the world, then that's a strange thought to begin with. I was in the middle of the military in the South Pacific, and right in the middle of the war, I felt peaceful and happy. I mean, if you get blown up, you get blown up, so goodbye, so that took care of that. In the meantime, you might as well whistle and go about your business.
Uh-huh.
So you can have peace of mind in the middle of mayhem. And you see how people are attracted to that which is violent and non-peaceful. So let's take Iran. They're having an election. Half the population pours out onto the streets and gets into riots and gets their heads beaten in by billy clubs. I mean, what are they doing out on the street?
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing out on the street? If there was a riot out there, the last place I want to be is out on the street. You know what I'm saying? So you see how people are attracted by the excitement of the negative. The excitement of the negative. And getting out there and getting involved in that which is destructive instead of maintaining an inner peace and seeing the human phenomena come and go.
And so with someone who gets, you know, cancer or something at a young age, is that because of, I guess I'm trying to understand why that happens, if they tend to be a positive person?
Well, they may be a positive person, you mean socially or generally.
Uh-huh.
But they have certain negativities within themselves about themselves. And so we try to locate what those belief systems are and change them over to the positive. Because even if you have defects of character or emotional defects, it doesn't mean you're stuck with them for a lifetime, nor does it mean that they have to become dominant. They can only be transitory, and you can find out what is the negative thought precisely, and how would one counter it? How can one look at life differently and counter that negative thought?
And how do we change our thoughts?
Well, we do it through, first of all, self-education. And I always believe everybody should have a mentor or a therapist. Everybody should have a psychotherapist, frankly. People say, I don't need a psychotherapist. Everybody needs a psychotherapist. You need a counselor. You need someone you can trust that gives you feedback. So you think you're a positive person, but every time the subject of your mother comes up, you've got a nasty, angry, negative, resentful thought. So there's a reservoir of negativity somewhere within the personality, and you try to search out where is that negativity or pessimism or anger or resentment. There, there's a saying, there are no justified resentments. Resentments have to do with yesterday. Today is today, so why do you have yesterday's resentment with you today? It's what you said to me last week. So, yeah, but you're harboring it today. That was 7 days ago. So we see the great value of spiritual principles, that the past is over, forget it, forgive and forget. And I always say, to have a positive attitude towards everything in life. You know, there's a benefit in everything. For one thing, it makes you value your life when you almost lose it.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying we get really focused on the past, on maybe something that happened or an argument or something, and that happened last week, and today is today, but we're having this internal dialogue in our brain about that, and it's creating energy in our body.
That's what's going on, right. And it creates a negative energy and activates the negative side of the brain and releases, stress hormones. So negative thoughts release stress hormones. For one thing, they result in guilt. Person says, well, I can hate that person, it doesn't affect me, but they're not aware of the fact that they have unconscious guilt. So negative attitudes and things have a concomitant cost, and that cost is a decrease of self-esteem. We can do this when we measure a person's level of consciousness. You know, we can do that by a simple test of the strength of the arm. If you hold something in mind and have somebody press down on your arm, if what you're holding in mind is positive or true, your arm stays strong. If what you're holding in mind is negative or false, your arm goes weak. And this is because the universe, the infinite field of consciousness itself, is completely and totally aware of what is truthful and what is not truthful. So the fact that everybody in the country believes it doesn't make it true.
Mm-hmm.
And the most common malarkey right now is that, you know, humans are responsible for Earth warming. That's the dumbest thought I've ever heard. You know, didn't you ever get over in an airplane? You fly for hours and hours. You don't see a single person on the desert. They tell me how mankind is causing the globe to warm up. Well, if you test that with the level of truth, it comes out as false. You know, when I wrote that in a book called Truth versus Falsehood. So people believe, you know, in the extraordinary madness of. There's a book on extraordinary mass delusions, a very famous book, and traces how mankind, generation after generation, holds as very popular beliefs that are entirely extraneous. Extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds, by Mackey. And the extraordinary delusions of today are. The Earth is warming up due to human influence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Earth couldn't care less about human influence. actually, if you use the same test of truth, and you say the temperature of the Earth is due to the sunspot activity of the surface of the sun, you'll get true. The sunspot activity of the surface of the sun is completely what dominates the temperature of Earth. And as they recede, it goes up, and as they come forth, and the temperature goes the other way. So, but mankind loves these delusional belief systems, and of course the politicians get out there and beat the drum and try to make hay out of them. So why do people have such prevailing false beliefs? Because they get a lot of juice out of it. What juice do they get? They get the juice of the ego. And the basic problem then is man's narcissism. The narcissism. So you feel very important going on making speeches about Earth warming and all. And it has nothing to do with the facts whatsoever.
So with the arm test, because I've used the arm test with my children,
yeah.
And they're 7 and 9, and it seems to work well. And in the book you talk about doing the arm test, you have to do it on people with a certain energy level. What is that?
Well, the person that you use for testing should, you know, be over 200 themselves. In other words, you don't want a person who is non-integrous, because they're not going to give you the right answer. So you choose somebody else, a child. I did a couple of films showing and doing it with children. And the innocence of the child, and I would ask them, what is this? And of course, common belief systems are very powerful, so it's hard to find somebody that hasn't already been brainwashed. So I did a film in which I said, you know, everybody thinks tobacco will kill you, so if you hold a package of cigarettes, it should make people go weak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's supposedly due to the tobacco. I said, well, here's tobacco, homegrown tobacco, grew it out in the field myself. The difference is it has no pesticides on it. So if you take homegrown tobacco with no pesticides and test it with kinesiology, the arm will go strong. It's just a vegetable like any other vegetable. It's not inherently a killer, you see what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
All right, so negative belief systems then are the source of the illnesses. And people say, well, I don't believe those things. And I say, well, you pick it up from the collective consciousness of mankind. If everybody thinks that, you know, man is changing the temperature of the globe by having a barbecue in the back of the yard, you're going to be subject to that and the guilt about it. So man runs from, you know, negative thoughts of one type to another.
This is Karen Motokaitis, and I have an announcement to make. Davis Relay for Life, American Cancer Society, August 15th through 16th, 2009, from 10 a.m. to 10 a.m. at Emerson Junior High School. Go to www.relayforlife.org/Davis, California. If you're interested in forming a team or joining a team, please go directly to our website or contact Bernadette Sangervasi at bsangervasi@gmail.com or call 530-848-8101. This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you are listening to How She Really Does It. I am talking with Dr. David Hawkins. For more information on him, you can go to his website, www.veritaspub.com. So, Dr. Hawkins, I want to talk about this idea of surrender and what the difference between passivity and acceptance is.
Well, passivity is coming from like a weakness. Acceptance means that you're willing to accept the truth of the matter. Passivity means that you're vanquished by it, that there's nothing you can do about it. So it's sort of a defeatist versus a courageous attitude. So let's say you accept the fact that allergies run in your family.
Mm-hmm.
And then you become active about it, and you discover, you know, what precipitates this? What can I do about this? How can I change that belief system? Another helpful thought sometimes as a way out of this dilemma has to do with karma. So instead of feeling guilt about many things that happen in life, if you know how to use the test for truth, you can say, is this a karmic proclivity? Karma is not too popular in the Western world, but in the Eastern world, it's accepted as a obvious basic fact of life. And so sometimes you can pick up it's a karmic propensity. Karmic propensity. You might say, well, how come this kind of a relationship recurs over and over in my life? And it's because you've inherited. A whole thought pattern and belief system about these kinds of relationships. That's why a therapist or a mentor or a spiritual counselor, I think, is helpful to almost everyone. You know, almost everyone could be helped by positive feedback. And when I was in psychoanalysis, every analyst had their own consulting analyst. And when I did analysis myself, I also had a consulting analyst. Somebody that I trusted and I looked up to and that I saw once a month, I said, you know, this is how I think things are going this month. I don't know if I'm developing in this area that I want to develop or not, or whether I'm neglecting it, or just am I just being a perfectionist? I think it's really very helpful to have a counselor or a trusted colleague that you can share your thoughts and belief systems with and how your life is going and the various patterns that show up, you know.
And so when you talk about having somebody that you can go and talk to about your thoughts, is that just so that you can have the space and the safety of just working on it and also maybe putting the time around committing that time to yourself about, okay, I'm going to work on these thoughts that I may have?
I think, first of all, to just have a colleague or a close friend or a counselor means that you are not in denial.
Uh-huh.
To think you're so perfect that you never need to look at yourself and examine what's going on with you with anybody shows a certain degree of ignorance, denial, and arrogance. There's hardly anybody in the world so perfect that they wouldn't benefit by discussing a few things in their life with others once in a while. So I think it shows a healthy attitude that all of us benefit by a positive kind of two-way communication with people who have our best interest in mind. You know, everybody had a priest or a counselor or a confessor or a minister or a doctor or somebody, a lawyer, or somebody that they looked up to that they could just sort of compare notes with and say, you know, this such and such a thing seems to keep happening over and over again. I don't know what's the matter with me that I fall into the same pit all the time. And then you begin to pick up these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And also unrealistic expectations of yourself, you know. If your child gets a D in spelling, you don't have to throw yourself on the floor as a failure as a mother, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So we also have a tendency to be too hard on ourselves very often, and that creates guilt and unconscious guilt.
In your book, and you were talking about spiritual learning and growth, and what tends to happen is that, you know, people may go and they may do their studies, and then a crisis comes and they advert their studies and they're dealing with the crisis instead of seeing it as an opportunity for growth. Tell me where I'm wrong with that.
Well, no, a crisis, you know, brings, it's like your unconscious is saying, oh yeah. You know, you say, I believe in being benevolent towards all beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then something will come up and the guy backs into you in the parking lot, and now you got to put your money where your mouth is. I mean, are you going to bawl him out and say, you clumsy idiot, how come you did that? When it happens to me, you know, it did happen to me, and I felt sorry for the guy. He backed right into my fender in a parking lot. So I got out and I said, listen, don't feel bad about it. It happens to everybody. Here's my insurance company. Give me your insurance card. And I said, don't feel bad about it, for God's sake. You know, you can't drive thousands of miles a year without having a fender bender once in a while. So the guy was very thankful, and I could see that his guilt load was relieved, and he, you know, it didn't destroy his day. It didn't make him happy, but, you know, he didn't go home feeling guilty and berating himself, and how could I be so stupid? And so we want to protect other people from the downside of human nature. So I think being one of the ways to be successful in the world is to try to be everybody's best friend. Try to present the most positive aspects of human nature in every incident that may occur. I mean, let's say today a very famous person died, and it's all over the media.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up that he may have been using addicting drugs. Well, in his lifestyle, the celebrity lifestyle, the use of mind-altering drugs is pretty darn common, isn't it? So, you know, I would say, well, he did whatever he felt was necessary to maintain a certain level of functioning. And if we put ourselves in the other person's moccasins, you know, we would see life differently. I don't know how you handle the stress of going out on a stage with thousands of people screaming and yelling and carrying on. And if you make one slip up, it's all over the planet within 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Just the tremendous stresses these people are under. So I think it benefits us and them if we're forgiving. I mean, whatever he had to do to maintain the kind of lifestyle he had, I guess he had to do that. So we have a certain compassion for the human condition. So I think overall we all benefit, ourselves and everybody around us, by compassion for the human condition and its inherent limitations. If we could be smarter, we would be. If we could be more courageous, we would be. We could be more forgiving, we would be. So, you know, we're always comparing ourselves to the hypothetical. Instead of the hypothetical, we should compare ourselves to the real. What's really possible? What's really possible is that we can choose to have a more beneficial attitude towards life and towards others and towards human beings and even towards animals, you know, to forgive them. A forgiving attitude. Well, once you do that, you activate the right brain, and the right brain then releases endorphins. So if if I'm worried about this guy feeling guilty about denting my fender, and I try to make him feel better, don't worry about it. I said, you got insurance, I got insurance. It's just a nuisance, that's all it is. So what's happening is I'm releasing endorphins in my own brain, and he feels forgiven, and heck, I guess it isn't all that bad, so he's releasing endorphins in his brain. Now you can picture the opposite scenario where I get out and shake my fist and say, you stupid idiot, you, I'm going to sue the hell out of you, give me your goddamn lawyer's number, and raise hell. Then the adrenaline gets released and the cortisone gets released, and both of us get ulcers.
I
like to compare two lifestyles. One is benign, in which you're cordial towards all of life, no matter what. And the other is you go down the tubes, the way of the raging mobs in, where is it they're killing each other, someplace around the clock.
Well, we've been getting some questions as we're live on the radio right now for you, and I think you answered one of the questions. It was, do our thoughts only affect ourselves, or do they have an impact on others, a collective unconscious?
The collective, we're subject to the collective. So instead of feeling guilty about certain negative attitudes, belief systems, et cetera, you can say to yourself, you know, that's in the collective consciousness of mankind. Man is always looking for a scapegoat. He's also looking for something that he can blame himself and his fellow human beings, you know, blame other Americans, or look at this guy out or going around the world blaming America for stuff, apologizing for America. Was he ashamed of America, for Christ's sake? You know, I mean, why is he running around apologizing? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of just being human. You know, this country isn't as perfect as we'd like it to be, but neither is theirs. So you don't have to run around apologizing. You know, we didn't start World War II. We didn't start World War I. We didn't start the Korean War. We didn't start the Vietnam War. Start the Gulf War. Everybody has to play their part and then take their responsibility.
When I think that fender, that getting in the car accident, little fender bender, was a great example of, you know, how our thoughts can be, how people can receive our thoughts without the verbal communication behind it.
Yes, our intention towards others. So I think to have a positive intention towards others, just a forgiving, benign, to come from graciousness towards all of life. You know, even the little spider walking across the window, you know, it doesn't mean you harm, and you don't have to hate them, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So to have goodwill. So there's one motto we can all live by, and that's to have goodwill towards all of life and all of its expressions. That'll never fail you. Goodwill towards all of life and all of its expressions.
Dr. Hawkins, do you have much stress in your life?
I don't know what stress is. You know, stress is really resisting how things are.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to be rather benign about it. Instead of resisting how it is, I just do whatever is practical to do about it, and also change my attitude about it, I can. Stress is internal, not external. There is no such thing as stress out there. All stress is in here. If a loud noise is stressful, it's not the noise's fault. It's that you're experiencing it as stress. And, you know, stress is due to resistance. If you're at a football game, you think loud noises are wonderful. It's because you're not resisting them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So stress comes from is an internal affair, from resistance of what is.
In your book, you talk about really feeling the feeling, and why is that so important?
Well, we try to undo remember SEST, Earhart Seminars Training, used to call a stack. In other words, we tend to repress feelings in this lifetime, plus many previous ones as well. So we tend to repress them, and what happens is you then have a whole energy field of suppressed negative feelings, angers and resentments and self-pities and all those kind of things. So I said the way to get over it is instead of avoiding a negative feeling, the thing to do is to give into it and allow it to all come up. Just like drain that negative battery of all of its energy. If you're mad, you're not mad enough. Lay on the floor and get mad and curse and pound your fists on the floor and helpless fury and lament to God and rage and shake your fist. How can you allow this to happen to me? And, you know, and allow all that suppressed energy, resentment, anger, self-pity, to come up. And when you do that, you like drain the battery of that energy. People have all these suppressed negative feelings, and the minute something happens in life that gives them an excuse to release it, they release it. But they had it there all along. They didn't just get the first resentment of their life when that guy backed into your fender. You've been pushing down resentments your whole life. Yep. You know?
Yes. And now...
So you take advantage of letting up a stack of negative feelings, and eventually they will run out. If you let up fear, fear will run and run and run. Fear of this, then fear of that, then fear of the other thing. Eventually, the bottom of the stack of fear is always fear of death. Symbolically, fear is always fear of death. So if you let go of your fears, I'll get this, and then I'll get that, and then they'll take my leg off, and then my wife will leave me, and then I'll lose my job, and then I'll be poverty-stricken, and then I won't have anything to eat, and then I say, and then what? And then I'll die. That's what you're afraid. You'll die of starvation, all alone, neglected, laying on the desert in the hot summer sun. And you can feel so sorry for yourself. Well, I could say, look, you got to get out of this world someplace. Karmically, human beings come to an end. So the sooner you accept the fact that death is inevitable, the less you'll be afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sooner or later, we're all going to croak. We're all going to fall over, stop breathing, turn blue, call the emergency room. That's how we get out of here.
I am wrapping up our discussion with Dr. David Hawkins, who has an upcoming event about peace. You can go to his website, www.veritaspub.com, for more information. You're listening to Karen Motokaitis on How She Really Does It. Speaking of fear, Dr. Hawkins, I had highlighted in your book a comment that you wrote about fear. It says, we think that this fear is coming from the world and we blame the world for it. We think that it is fearful experience happening out there. Little do we realize that it is merely our own fearfulness that is being projected out into the world.
That's right. The phenomena of the world give you an excuse to experience it, but it's there all the time. Because I've also been in, you know, World War II in situations that were, you know, objectively speaking, very, very fearful. You're going to blow up any second. And felt no fear whatsoever. I say, you know, the other guy's looking at me, and his mine is floating right next to the ship, and we're trying to keep this mine from touching the ship, because if one of these horns touches the hull of the ship, we're going to blow up. And so we have these long boat hooks that we're trying to hold this mine, and it's coming up and down in the waves closer and closer to the ship, and we're trying to hold it off. And so this guy says to me, what happens if we can't keep this away from it? So I said, then we blow up and die. He says, oh, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Once he said that, yeah, that's right, his fear went away, and we pushed that mine away. And, of course, I'm still here, so obviously you were successful. Anyway, that mine did blow up a little way from the ship. And a piece of shrapnel just missed my jugular vein and sunk into the bulkhead of the ship. And I dug it out later with a penknife, and I still have it in my jewelry box.
Wow.
A piece of shrapnel that just about cut my jugular. Yeah, so accepting at the bottom of the stack, death is not the worst thing that can happen to you. I mean, you know, what happens is you leave the body. Anybody who's had a near-death experience, of which I've had several, what happens is suddenly you're out of the body, and you're feeling fine, you're feeling happy, and you're here, and there's the body laying over there in the bed. And so you realize that experience, you realize that which you are in reality is not your body in the first place. That which you are is an energy field of consciousness independent of the body, and it periodically reincarnates in a physical humanness form. But in and of itself, you know, it's not dependent on the body. The first time it happened, I was gravely ill. I'd had hemorrhaging, almost hemorrhaged to death, and I was in this hospital bed. And all of a sudden, I was 6 feet over the body. There I was, 6 feet over the body, feeling fine. I looked down at the body, and God, he looked really bad. He looked pretty bad, to tell you the truth. And I thought he looked like he could go any time. But it just didn't bother me, because who I was separate from the body. That's the first time it happened. I was in psychoanalysis at the time, and I told him about the experience, and he never heard about a body experience. So he thought it was some kind of delusion. But it happened later in life in other circumstances. And so if you've been fortunate enough to have a near-death experience or an out-of-body experience, if you've never been out of body, you can always go to the Monroe Institute there, back east there in Virginia or someplace. You know, Robert Monroe wrote the book, famous book, Journeys Out of the Body. Nobody ever heard of out of body experiences. And he began having them every night and had all kinds of adventures in the astral realms and wrote this book. It ended up as the Monroe Institute, where you can go there, and in 10 days they teach you how to leave the body and go anywhere you want in the astral dimensions. And that's something I did later on, too, just for fun, that you could go out of body at, you know, at will. I stay in body just out of habit now, but occasionally if you want, you can leave the body anytime you want and go anywhere you want. If you want to know what's inside of a box, you just leave the body, go inside the box, see what's there, come back out of the box, go back in the body, and report to the people there what it says in the box. I did that too. I went into the box, and I projected myself into the box. Red was in there and came out, and I said, "There's a tag, and it says hello." Like when you're a visitor someplace, they put a tag on you. Hello, my name is George or something. I said, "The tag says my name is." That's what it says, and everybody was happy as a clam. That proved you could do it. Yeah, I can go into a box, read what's there, and come back out again. I'd make a heck of a foreign agent, wouldn't I? A foreign spy. I could go to their files, read what's in there, and come back out. You think of the funny things you can do with it.
Well, Dr. Hawkins, I appreciate you coming back on the show today. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me, and I hope we said things that might be interesting to some people in the audience.
Oh, absolutely. We're getting a lot of positive feedback, so thank you very much. All right, Dr. Hawkins, take care. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye.
This is Karen Motokaitis, and thanks for listening to How She Really Does It on KDRT LP 95.7 FM. We love to hear our listeners' comments about our shows or questions for upcoming guests. You can email us by going to our website, www.howshereallydoesit.com. Or you can tweet us at www.twitter.com/KarenMotokaitis. Our past shows are available on our website or as podcasts from iTunes. LP 95.
My name is Beth Banks, and I'm the senior minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis. I welcome you to these few minutes of storytelling in our program, Sparks from the Flame. For more information about the UU Church of Davis, please visit our website at www.uudavis.org. The views expressed in this piece are not necessarily those of KDRT.
My name is Ray Kopik. I've been a member of the UU Church of Davis since the 1960s, and I'd like to read three poems here today. The first poem was inspired by something seen in the High Sierra, That is what's called glacial erratics. Those are stones, some small, some as big as a house. They're carried by glaciers and then deposited when the glacier melts a long way from home. And the title of the poem is The Exiles. Held lonely by cliffs the color of shadow, the basalt plateau crests clean above the pines. There's black lava from some midnight of time. And there's dry grass in the cracks. And seven smooth, light-struck and silver granite boulders. I know they came to this high, silent place riding on a glacier. But that doesn't tell me why, when I lean against their alien weight, I am comforted. And the next poem is simply called The Dreamer. I know that words won't do to build a fire, to see a star, to know a whispered voice. Yet here I am again, with language lost as I, and silence sometimes speaks to me. It asks me, what's my talisman? A stone, I say, an amulet of solitude, a flinty secret orb of innerness, a twilight stone that tells the dreamer, dream. And the third poem has a rather grandiose title of Why They Built the Golden Gate Bridge. It comes from some work I was doing on the church grounds. With a narrow spade, I dug a ditch and took it for a masterpiece. Each shovelful composed and clean, a unit in the mind, and the straight line savored like a tipped spear aimed at an enemy's ribs. It's not enough, the unanswerable riddle of softness and the young ones. Men seek enchantment of the squared edge, like a war cry or an abstract truth, comforting and dangerous.
For more information on the UU Church of Davis, please visit our website at www.uudavis.org.